This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Today, Charles Olson is going to give some kind of talk or discussion about Melville.
It was curious that I wrote a thing last week, and again he walked right into the middle of it, so that's why I was laughing at the fact that I had again been involved in him. And I thought before I came that it would be an interesting way to suggest how much he has stood for and stands for. I don't have too much sense of how much of Melville you all know. Like Paul Weiner says, I hadn't realized that Moby Dick had become a school classic like Lawrence said it was. My father gave it to me when I was a kid, and that's a lucky way to get it if you can, I guess. And it wasn't in schools, as a matter of fact. It was, I wonder when it came into schools. I didn't know it was a school book. But then, you see, I said to Paul, well, that's fine. There's a lot of other books. How, just offhand, how much do any of you have even, say, like Moby Dick or beyond him? Yeah. So it's a little difficult talking about him without, honestly, having read him or having a beef about him like Paul does.
Is he in high school?
I guess so. Don't you, Paul? Junior high. Yeah. I suppose it's become it's probably a cut up edition, a cut down edition. Yeah. Like my son has read it in that wonderful one that what do you call the illustrated classics, the comic strip? Those beauties, they're really the best of all. They really have some meat in them, those things. But I started this piece, I hate the spirit of streets. The spirit, anyway, of the nation went away at some point of time between 1765 and 1770. And a man born at about then, therefore a son, son of those men who made the revolution, was already, in the first years of the 19th century, crying us down accurately. James Fenimore Cooper, that early. All which, writing, including the hump up of the middle of the 19th century, did insist upon, and Melville had already passed American art out into the geometry which alone, until time re-entered about 1948, was what was making things possible again. What it was that did break in the moment of time in the 18th century must have been what Giles Clayes has said, I'm sure as well as anyone, that when men are still putting down houses to live in and wish to make food, and work to make food, excuse me, the earth is still lived on. When that breaks, Captain Soames's house on Lower Middle Street is the possibility at its last moment here on the new continent. When it broke, all had to be begun again. The critique of Cooper was so complete, all after was simply going to live it out until today, or at least until 1949. Any change, any new change, had to be toward earth, not, again, Giles Clay, not a cross. And that is provoked by an article by a guy named Giles Clay in a less of Sheets and Destiny, but a similar sheet and done very similarly, which came in this last week from Pocatello, Idaho, which is called a pamphlet and has no advertising. But otherwise, it's exactly like what Weiner is doing here here, it's done because everything that the college does at the University of Idaho, the editors of this magazine find doesn't equal the need. So they now have, in fact, this issue is to publish three poems of Edward Dorn, whom I mentioned to Ernie yesterday, among the younger poets. And I think you have his last book, The Newly Formed. But suddenly in the back, I was reading the thing, and here's a piece by a former editor of a pamphlet called Omnia Mea Mecum Porto, which I'd like to read you. Nate sat in his room, staring at the same walls that probably his father had stared at all through Europe, and he thought, perhaps, there is room somewhere in Austria or Hungary, just like this one, with the faded blue plaster crumbling and peeling, and the stained water murals. One generation American who is now living the shell that was destroyed long ago, before there was electricity and television. I didn't last long as my ancestors remained in Europe, but then they were still building buildings for shelter and working for food. And what have I to do with a hammer but set off a chain reaction? And they still had dreams of fortunes and Junker estates along the Donau and Strauss waltzes captured in Moselle wine. And I can hear them shout, build that house, plant those crops the Huns have left us long centuries ago and deposited their seeds in our soil. And a new generation later, one of my ancestors put rosin on his eyes to decrease the epicanthric fold and requested a visa to Oberammergau. And they were still building when Herr Schickelgruber came marching over Vineyard shouting, Heute hört uns Deutschland und morgen die ganze Welt, and loaded up boxcars of dreamers with aller Rede, Nissen, Roland, Roland Ferdinand Sieg written on the side, and deposited their ashes over the pastures of Deutschland in the years following the wine crop was excellent. So my father, singing to himself, Omnia mea mecum porto, traveled across ashes with a rifle in his rectum and spent tormenting nights in hotels such as this, telling himself that America would be different. And when the boat left Lisbon, he lived like a pig in the bottom deck, crammed in with 800 other visionaries, and at 8 knots a day across the Atlantic while German planes above were skywriting, dem die Toten reiten schnell. New York City is a blackout and the war became a reality. He found all the ghettos completely filled and someone said, foreigners are not allowed, but then this is war and you should try Jersey. And my father found a job and procured a wife in a cafe next door. And then the apartment was filled with a screaming youth who thought his mother's tit was paradise. But the war did not end in 1945 and I was fighting with gravel in my elbows and wiping the blood from my nose. And my father said that things will be better with a college education. But I found out early that no one really respects education, but only for the pragmatic diploma that lets you sell life, death, hospital, car accident, baby, home, crop failure, insurance, and what can be insured when no one is living and there are no crops. And I saw man's exterior crumbling and the psychiatrist treating the interior when there was no interior to treat. There is no home to build, Father. The ground is sterile, the people impotent, and I instinctively headed west, for I saw no purpose. And I kept going as my greatest grandfather did as he chased dreams across the Gobi Desert. And what did he find but no purpose? And so I kept chasing myself until I reached San Francisco and this room with some understanding of inseparability with the universe. And with no purpose, I was liberated. And I checked on a boat to the Orient where Tim Sung was waiting for me inside Buddha's triple body with no ego and where there is an innate trust in good and evil. And here is balance, and not the land of used car salesmen, and was flowers over dead people that had always been dead, because the westward migration of man had been too soon based on greed and wealth and exterior pomp. And so I am leaving America in the womb of a saline world of Pacific, for I am going to be reborn inside the world, and I know that the circle would be completed, and the last of man's migration, for the next migration, would be inside of the world and not across. Now, a guy named Gino Clays, who was the previous editor, according to this, Gino Clays, former editor of AP, meaning a pamphlet, back from your blistering Baghdad on Portneuf. I'm interested in actually doing that book on Melville that some years ago now was to arrest the West. In fact, I was so disappointed when everything didn't stop. I knocked me out for 5 months. I couldn't imagine how the world could have this book and not to catch up. So since then, I've been continuing to write things on Melville. All sorts of things happened once during it. Like in 1951, they were going to have a centennial celebration of Moby Dick at Williams College. So I wrote and we published at Black Mountain a poem called Letter to Melville, 1951. And that's in that volume, The Distances. And I was amused to see some reviewer attacking that book in the Hudson Review or something, saying, boy, that Olson has to look around for subjects if all he can find to complain about is a meeting of the Melville Society in Williamstown.
Can you read that?
I can't find a copy. I must have lost it since I've been here. Somebody got my distances? Oh, wait. Oh, I think it's probably in. Maybe in here. Yeah, here it is. Instead of reading all that sort of stuff that was at the moment valuable occasionally, which was the whole attack upon the academic side, myself rather go to the plot that was what you were writing the poem for, which was just to write a poem about Mr. Melville. Except this little Hans, which the thing is composed so that it's a critique and an essay and a poem in one. Let me just read little pieces of it before I want to read you a later thing, the last thing I've written on Melville, just so we're closer to the present. And to Gino Clays, I think. So the meeting is the big business about the dormitories and all that. Timed in such a way to avoid him, to see he gets a lot of lip, who hung in a huge jaw, and no service at all, none of this chicken he, who is beyond that sort of recall, beyond any modern highway which would have saved him from sciatica. Well, that we cannot do for him, but we now know so much we can make clear how he erred, how, in other ways, we have made such studies and we permit ourselves to think they allow us to tell each other how wise he was. He was. Few flying fish, no dolphins, and in that glassy sea, two very silly whales throwing that spout of theirs you might call sibylline. It disappears so fast. Why, this year, 100 years ago, he had moved on, was offering to such as these a rural bowl of milk, subtitled The Ambiguities. July, above Sigsby's Deep, the Lucera del Alba, 500 tons, 200,000 board feet of mahogany, the captain, 25, part Negro, part American Indian, and perhaps a little of a certain Sereno by name, Orestes Camargo. Herman Melville looked up again at the weather, noted that landlessness, and it was not so much truth as he had thought, even though the Ratlins could still take his weight, 185, eyes blue, hair auburn, a muscular man, knowing that knowledge is only what makes a ship shape, takes care of the precision of the cross sign, the feather and the anchor, the thing which is not the head but is where they cross the edge, the moving edge of force, the web of sea and sky, or land and sky, the Egyptian, the American backwards. The stern at evening a place for conversation, to drop paper boats, to ask why clouds are painter's business, why now he would not write Moby Dick. Was writing, Pierre. The world had moved on. In that hallway moved north, northeast, had moved him. Oh, such fools, neither of virtue nor of truth to associate with. To sit to table by at once, as once before you. Well, this goes back to, I'm talking to Melville's granddaughter, who took me once to Pittsfield many, many years ago, when, long before this celebration, when I was a kid, and Mumford gave the main speech at a banquet to him, and drank water. Toast, this was what murdered me, it was a toast in plain drinking water. So I go back to them. But then I wanted to really slice at some of all, there's quite a few critics of Melville, as your friend well knows. There's been a tremendous amount, it's become an academic industry. Another reason why the subject of Melville today, thank God I'm here and we're in this situation, we can talk about it with some life, because really there's been this tremendous thing. Again, like when I first went there to Pittsfield, there was no Melville Society, and there was no organized business, and it was simply a bunch of friends. But then even then, like, there was drinking water. So I won't read this long smash against one guy in particular who wrote, has been the editor and has written most of Melville books of the last few years. Myself, I'd like to extricate you who have the blood of him, and another who loves him as a doctor knows, a family doctor, how his mother stayed inside him, how the compact came out hate, and what this kept him from, despite how far he traveled. The matchbox with a match for mass goes backward gaily, bumping along the wake. What they'll forget, they'll smother you, is there is only one society. There is no other than how many we do not know. Where and why they read a book, and that the reading of a book can save a life. They do not come to banquets, and Nathaniel Hawthorne, whom Herman Melville loved, will not come, nor Raymond Weaver, who loved them both because they loved each other. You have the right to be there because you loved an old man's walk and took a little attic box and books. And there is he, the doctor, whom I love, and by his presence, side by side with you, will speak for Melville and myself. He, who was himself saved, who, because in the middle of the Atlantic an appendectomy was called for, read a sea story once, and since has gone by the pole star, a scalpel overside for rudder, has moved on from Calypso, huge in the dispatch of the quicksilver god. Yet I wish so very much that neither of you mixed, as lighter has it in this middle place, in such salad as these caterers will serve. For you will have to hear one very bright man speak, so bright he'll sound so good that every one of you will think he knows whereof he speaks. He'll say such forward things. He'll tag the deific principle in nature, the heroic principle in man. He'll spell what you who do not have such time to read as he. Such definitions, so denotatively clear, you'll think you'll understand. Discourse is such a lie that Herman Melville was no professional, could not accomplish such mentality, and so, as amateur, as this clear neuter will make clear, was anguished all his life in struggle. Now with himself he'll say, oh no, not with when shall I eat my lunch. Elizabeth has said outside the door so quiet, it was not even a mouse. My prose today is likewise the cows. What a damn nuisance they also are. Why do I continue to extend my language horizontally when I damn well know what is a water spout? No, he'll skillfully confuse you. He knows such words as mythic, Such adjectives that fall so easily they'll think it's true. Melville was a risky but creative mingling. How they put words on it, this lad was so, who stowed himself with roaches in a blue shining corpse at age 60. Hey, Jackson, the diced bones. Now this too, he, who is also of the one society, who likewise lifted altars too high, a typewriter in a tree, and spilled himself into the honey head, died the blood ant so pleasantly. As though he did not want to woo, to chance a Bronx grave, preferred to choose his own headland. All these you will sit with, a mingling he will drone on, of the fortunate and the injurious. And only you and Harry, who knows, will not be envious, will know that he knows not one thing, the brightest of these mischievous men, who does not know that it is not the point, either of the book or the plume which lies cut on this brave man's grave, on all of us, but that where they cross his motion, where they constantly moving cross anew, cut this new instant open, as he is who, in this weekend in his old place, presumed on. I tell you, he'll look on you all with an eye you have the color of. He'll not say a word, because he need not. He said so many. Now, some time after that, I did two pieces in the New Republic on Melville, in which the title was The Materials and Weights of Herman Melville. That was a year later. And I was involved in quantity much more clearly than I had been when I wrote Ishmael. And about three years ago, when the Chicago Review was changing into the big table, and there was the whole shove of Zen Buddhism upon the nation, I was asked to review for the review, for the Chicago Review, a new book on Melville by another one of those fellows, but which had the greatest reach of title I think has ever been tried on Melville. Melville, I think it's in Moby Dick, characterized Solomon's wisdom as the fine hammered steel of woe. And this guy writing a PhD thesis at the University of Illinois wrote a book called The Fine Hammered Steel of Herman Melville, which I was asked to review. And just to I'll read this, and then we can throw this thing open a little to further talk or questions. And this is the last thing I've done on him that I can think of, except for that reference in that paragraph this week. To some that were there yesterday afternoon, I promised to bring these matters up, but I see that not all that were there yesterday here today, but we'll carry it forward as though they were. We were talking yesterday on the situation of language again, and talking with Chuck. Was it Chuck? Yeah. I referred to John Keats and tried to get somebody to help me quote him, and now I found out later last evening that Chuck could have quoted the Eve of St. Agnes easily, but the son of a gun, he never opened his trap at the moment. In the year Melville was born, John Keats, walking home from the Mummers' play at Christmas, 1819, and afterwards, excuse me, yes, in the year Melville was born, John Keats, walking home from the Mummers play at Christmas, 1819. And afterwards, he'd had to listen to Coleridge again. Thought to himself, all that irritable reaching after fact and reason, it won't do. I don't believe in it. I do better to stay in the condition of things. No matter what it amounts to, mystery, confusion, doubt, it has a power. It is what I mean by negative capability. Keats, without setting out to, had put across the century the inch of steel to wreck Hegel, if anything could. Within 5 years, two geometers, Bolyai and Lubachevsky, weren't any longer satisfied with Euclid's picture of the world, and they each made a new one, independently of each other, and remarkably alike. It took 31 years, Melville's age when he wrote Moby Dick, for the German mathematician Riemann to define the real as men since have exploited it. He distinguished two kinds of manifold, the discrete, which would be the old system, and it includes discourse, language as it had been since Socrates, and what he took to be more true, the continuous. Melville, not knowing any of this, but in it, even more as an American, down to his hips and things, was a first practicer. Rimbaud was born the year Riemann made his inaugural lecture in 1854 of the new equation, quantity as intensive. The idea on which this book is based, this fine hammered steel of Melville, naturalism, is useless to cope with Melville, either as a life lived in such a time or as an art. The first art of space to arise from the redefinition of the real, and in that respect free, for the first time since Homer, of the rigidities of the discrete. Naturalism was already outmoded by the events above, whether one takes it as an 18th or 19th century idea. Mr. Stern, that's the writer of the book, alas, takes it every way, including the unhappy thought that Melville can be put at the head of a literary use which includes Twain, Dreiser, Hemingway, and Faulkner. It is the error on matter sitting in naturalism which gives it its appeal, that by it one can avoid the real, which is what is left out, at what cost all over the place Mr. Stern is only one of the fools of. He writes, in summary of what he takes that Melville did prove, quote, that the naturalistic perception in the years of the modern could and must take from woe not only materialism, but also the humanism and the deep morality of social idealism, which are the true beginnings of wisdom. I'd like to repeat that. This is Stern's, this is the heart of this whole naturalist concept. I'm using that word naturalism as it's classically used, and I hope some of you are acquainted with it. It's kind of, I think it's not actually as a tag word used today, but much that's going on today, I think, is simply further naturalism. And it's not nature, it's not the other use, the thorough something. He writes, in summary of what he takes that Melville did prove, now this is his suggestion, this is what Melville did it all for, that the naturalistic perception in the years of the modern could and must take from woe not only materialism, but also the humanism and the deep morality of social idealism, which are the true beginnings of wisdom. The true beginnings of nothing but the supermarket. The exact death quantity does offer, if it is in numbers and extension and the appetite of matter, especially in human beings. The change the 19th century did bring about is being squandered by the 20th in ignorance and abuse of its truth. Melville was a part of the change, and I can do nothing in the face of this book but try to show how in terms of that change. He put it altogether accurately himself in a single sentence of a letter to Hawthorne written when he was writing Moby Dick, 1851. Quote, by visible truth, We mean the apprehension of the absolute condition of present things. By visible truth, we mean the apprehension of the absolute condition of present things. All things did come in again in the 19th century. An idea shook loose. An energy in motion became as important as structure of things, as they were plural, and by matter, mass. It was even shown that in the infinitely small, the older concepts of space ceased to be valid at all. Quantity, the measurable and numerable, was suddenly as shafted into anything as it was also, as has been obvious, the striking character of the external world that all things do extend out. Nothing was now inert fact. All things were there for feeling, to promote it and be felt. And man, in the midst of it, knowing well how he was folded in, as well as how suddenly and strikingly he could extend himself, spring or without even moving, go too far, the farthest, he was suddenly possessed or repossessed of a character of being, a thing among things, which I shall call his physicality. It made a re-entry of, or to the universe. Reality was without interruption, and we are still in the business of finding out how all action and thought have been refounded. Taking it in towards writing, the discrete, for example, wasn't any longer a good enough base for discourse. Classification was exposed as mere taxonomy, and logic, and the sentence poised on it, a completed thought, instead of what it has become, an exchange of force, was as loose and inaccurate a system as the body and soul had been, divided from each other and rattling sticks in a stiff box. Something like this are the terms of the real and of action Melville was an early inheritor of, and he is either held this way or he is missed entirely. With one thing more, the measurement question. That's where I missed Chuck. Remember he said the poem can't be measured. With one thing more, the measurement question. What did happen to measure when the rigidities dissolved? When Newton's scholium turned out to be the fulling mill Melville sensed it was via Bacon, whom he called that watchmaker brain. This is one of the great passages in Pierre, is Melville's attack upon Bacon. And that's Francis Bacon. I guess none of you have ever read Pierre in this film, have you? This is a novel that if you pretend at all to be at grips with writing in your society, I swear that you couldn't. It's unbelievable, this book. It's a broken book of life in Vermont and New York City, written by Melville right after Moby Dick, and just absolutely busted by having done Moby Dick and carrying four children and keeping a farm down here just below us in the Berkshires and trying to make it, and then really broken after a year and a half of writing Moby Dick. He rolled right on into this book, and he actually went off his rocker, as far as anybody knows, because Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes was called one night, and the family finally got wise and got together and sent him off to Europe. But by this time, he'd written four more books, so it was obviously a lot later than Pierre. So he suffered much for several years, and then had this damn thing that I mentioned in that poem of having fallen off the farm wagon when it turned on a rut, and he had what they used to call sciatica. He obviously hit one of his vertebrae or something like that. So he really was never much good. I mean, he was plenty good, but he lived 70 more years. I mean, lived to be 70 or more, 72 I think, and worked for 20 years in a customs house in New York thereafter. But this Pierre is really I couldn't possibly suggest a book that will both take away the curse of Moby Dick in the sense of how that's been over-circulated, but only those who care, really. And then if they stumble into Pierre, they're done for. And The Confidence Man, which he wrote before he went on a trip to. I'm suggesting that Melville's critique of Bacon applies directly to Newton's scholium. What is measure when the universe flips, and no part is discrete from another part except by the flow of creation itself in and out, intensive where it had seemed before qualitative, and the extensive, exactly the widest, which we also have the powers to include. The rhythm suddenly, which had been so long the captive of meter, no matter how good, Shakespeare say in our own tongue or Chaucer, was a pumping of the real so constant, art had to invent measure anew. Watching Melville in a lifetime trying to make prose do what his body and his soul as a heap, watching Melville in a lifetime trying to make prose do what his body and his soul as a heap, and his mind on top of them a tangle, this is also a way of putting a man's physicality. Trying to get a measure of language to move himself into a book and over to another man's experience is a study makes more sense now in the midst of 20th century art, painting and music as well as narrative and verse, than it could have previously. It wasn't image. It wasn't anything he lacked. Possibly it was only any reason he might be confident he was right, taking it all so differently as he did from those around him, at least those known to him. Or say it as my friend Landau does, who swings with a confidence man, quote, Melville seems entitled to disillusion itself, and given his personal bitter life, possibly because of that vision in the scene, society, he had to live in it. Who still knows what's called for from physicality, how far it does cover and reveal? No one has yet tried to say how Melville does manage to give the flukes of the whale immediacy as such. It is easier to isolate his skill over technology than to investigate the topological, both in his soul and in his writing. But it is my experience that only such sense of form as the topological includes, able to discriminate and get in between the vague types of form morphology offers and the ideal structures of geometry proper, explains Melville's unique ability to reveal the very large, such a thing as this whale, or himself on whiteness, or Ahab's monomania, by the small. The new world of atomism offered a metrical means as well as a topos, different from the discrete. Congruence, which there in mathematicians' hands lifted everything forward after Lobachevsky, via Cayley especially, another contemporary of Melville, and Felix Klein, makes much sense, as no other meter does, to account for Melville's prose. Congruence was spatial intuition to Kant, and if I am right that Melville did possess its powers, he had them by his birth, from his time of the world, locally America. As it developed in his century, congruence, which had been the measure of the space a solid fills in two of its positions, became a point-by-point mapping power of such flexibility that anything which stays the same, no matter where it goes and into whatever varying conditions, it can suffer deformation. It can be followed. And if it is art, lead, including what is so important to prose, such physical quantities as velocity, force, and field strength. Melville's prose does things which its rhetoric would seem to contradict. He manages almost any time he wants to, for example, to endow a more general space than other writers, than anyone except Homer, I find. The delivery of Tashtigo from the whale's head, say. The point is also the overall space of Moby Dick. That space and those of which it is made up have the properties of projective space. Otherwise, they should all come out more familiar and round, because they would stay Euclidean. And I conclude that Melville could not have achieved what amounts to elliptical and hyperbolic spaces. He makes things stand out, at once transparent and homogeneous. If it were not using transformations which we have not understood, and which only congruence makes possible. The lack of it in his verse, as negativism in his life, such as Keats knew, is one of the ways of putting how far Melville didn't come. His ideas also. In spite of the vocabulary of his time, much more is to be read out of him, I suspect, than any of us have allowed. In the rest of the letter to Hawthorne, from which I have quoted, he goes on to discuss the effects of the absolute of present things on self and being and God, and his insistence there to get God in the street looks like the first-rate breakthrough of man's thought, which was called for in 1851, the necessary secularization of his part in the world of things. It doesn't diminish it that it was probably the only time in a lifetime in which Melville did manage to throw off the Semitic notion of transcendence. Or take him just where so much academicism has wasted its time on classic American literature, and Mr. Stern does again, the place of allegory and symbol in Melville and his contemporaries. As the master said to me in the dream, of rhythm is image, of images knowing, of knowing there is a construct. It is rather quantum physics than relativity which will supply a proper evidence here as against naturalism of what Melville was grabbing onto when he declared it was visible truth he was after. For example, that light is not only a wave but a corpuscle, or that the electron is not only a corpuscle but a wave. Melville couldn't abuse object as symbol does by depreciating it in favor of subject, or let image lose its relational force by transferring its occurrence as allegory does. He was already aware of the complementarity of each of two pairs of how we know and present the real, image and object, and action and subject, both of which have paid off just so decisively since. At this end, I am thinking of such recent American painting as Pollock's and Klein's and some recent American narrative and verse. And at his end, his whale itself, for example, what an unfolding thing it is as it sits there, written 100 years off, implicit, intrinsic, and incident to itself. Melville was not tempted, as Whitman was, and Emerson and Thoreau differently, to inflate the physical. Take the model for the house for the model, death is the open road, the soul or body is a boat, and so forth. Melville equally couldn't spiritualize it, as Hawthorne tried, using such sets as the mirror image, Monsieur de Miroir, and so forth, and Melville himself in the bell tower, but not in the Encantadas or Bartleby. And how explain the way the remark, the Negro, does hold off and free in Benito Sereno? Melville couldn't have known it to say it this way, but he was essentially incapable of either allegory or symbol for the best of congruent reason. Mirror and model are each figures in Euclidean space, and they are not congruent. They require a discontinuous jump. Finally, to take the possibilities here suggested at their fullest, the actual character and structure of the real itself. I pick up on calm or passivity, Melville's words, and about which he knew something, having served as a boat steerer himself on at least his third voyage on a whaler in the Pacific. He says somewhere a harpoon can only be thrown accurately from such repose as he likened the white whale to as it finally approached. A mighty mildness of repose in swiftness is his phrase. Likewise, in handling Ahab's monomania, he sets up a different sort of a possible man, one of a company which he calls the hustings of the divine inert. I am able to stress the several aspects of Melville's thought on this because note in each case the feeling or necessity of the inert, or of passivity as a position of rest, is joined to the most instant and powerful actions Melville can invent, the whale itself swiftness, Ahab's inordinate will, and the harpooner's ability to strike to kill from calm only. The inertial structure of the world is a real thing, which not only exerts effects upon matter, but in turn suffers such effects. I don't know a more relevant single fact to the experience of Moby Dick and its writer than this, unless it is the prior and lesser, but more characteristic Riemannian observation that the metrical structure of the world is so intimately connected to the inertial structure that the metrical field, odd as measure, will of necessity become flexible, what we are finding out these days in painting, writing, and music, the moment the inertial field itself is flexible. Which it is, Einstein established by the phenomena of gravitation and the dependence of the field of inertia on matter. I take care to be inclusive to enforce the point made at the start that matter offers perils wider than man if he doesn't do what still today seems the hardest thing for him to do outside of some art and science, to believe that things and present ones are the absolute conditions, but that they are so because the structures of the real are flexible. Quanta do dissolve into vibrations. All does flow and yet is there to be made permanent if the means are equal. Well, I'm sure that's much too written for the page, I suspect, that we read out loud. And especially, really, it must sound like I'm trying to be a philosopher. If you haven't read Mr. Melville, I think that the thing is very relevant to Melville. I myself find it more interesting than Ishmael simply because than the book I wrote, simply because it feels to me it's more in on how he was a poet and a writer. Because he was also a poet, I think it's one of the other crazy things that's happened in recent years that not only has Pierre and the Confidence Man risen in value, there's been a number of poets that have found Melville's poetry interesting to them. I'm not one of them, but I respect some men that have found that verse important to them. Those verses come late in his life. He wrote a whole book of poems on the Civil War called Battle Pieces, which includes, say, half a dozen that are among the poems that these men I speak of have value. And then in his when he got this job in the customs house, he occupied himself for some years with a two-volume novel in verse called Chlorel, or A Pilgrimage to the Holy Land, which almost nobody reads, even like these people I speak of. I thought Grove Press, I thought I'd succeeded in getting Grove Press to publish that as a paperback, which was about it as well. I mean, I was getting a publisher to risk his money. I was hoping it would work. I was asked to do an introduction to it, but I decided the best thing to do is to just get them to get it out. But I haven't seen it. I guess they really followed me up. They didn't do it. That's a crazy book, a two-volume novel in verse. Dig that. And it's written in tetrameters, which contradicts, I don't know when it doesn't contradict, but it shows you how difficult it was for him to get at problems of verse for himself. And then, in the last year of his life, he did publish two volumes, which I think are beauties. One is called Timoleon, a little paper book smaller than that, and much thinner. I mean, they're so big. And John Ma, Timoleon and John Ma, two volumes of late poems. Among which is a very great poem called After the Pleasure Party, which I wish I had my hands on at the moment I read it. I don't see any Melville on it. looked at. I'd suggest you. That's a wow. That's one of the. Now there's where I really pick up. I think that poem is one of the greatest ever. It's written to a woman who in Italy, whom he obviously met at a dinner party. And he gets her called Urania in the poem, which again sounds like him, to make her a goddess of astronomy. I guess, isn't it? Yes, sure. And it opens with these beautiful lines on amor threatening. And in the middle of the poem, he breaks out with a passage. Shy diffraction through life's gate. If I can get any of it, never. I can't at the moment. Shy diffraction through life. In terms of what I'm talking about here, both in statement and in image and in feeling and in and in dropping into the mass matter-ishness of the spirit of life, where if John was here I'd now say the Wahrheit lieth. The poem is everything gone in a little thing about 5 or 6 lines, just knock on. I always know those lines. I don't know why I can't quote them. I live with them. The only line I can get is shot the fractions through life's gate. Okay. Well, that's enough, I think, for me to shoot off about. I'd like very much now to deal with any questions you have or do a anything else. I could read you a story, which isn't very long, I think. The opening of the Ishmael, which is the closest I ever got to being successful in the movies. In fact, this book had a great history because it brought me to Hollywood, where I sat around waiting for Mr. Warner to return from the Côte d'Azur, and then interrupted by his desire to see the World Series. Meanwhile, I had little money, but then here was my golden chance, because I was going to be asked to advise on John Huston's Moby Dick because of this book, which was about a sillier. Then, did you see, there are some people that might think that Ishmael has something to do with existence. At least Mr. Huston was interested in existence, as you know, his movies, like The Treasure of Sierra Madre, which you'll see tomorrow night. But curiously enough, the real success I had was with a much more interesting director who read this story and said, I'll make it into a movie if you'll write it as a movie. And if you want to hear it, it's one of the desperate stories I think it's possible to hear, but it's a scene narrative, and that's always kind of palatable. The director was Jean Renoir, and as a Frenchman, it was clear that he didn't understand it. Would that be a good way to, how would that sit with you all? We can cut out and do otherwise if you'd like. I don't know what time I'm running. Anybody tell me what time it is?
4:00.
It's 4:00? Oh. I think this takes about 15 minutes, I should say. It's 7 pages. I open the book with it. It's called First Fact as prologue. Herman Melville was born in New York, August 1st, 1819, and on the 12th of that month, the Essex, a well-found whaler of 238 tons, sailed from Nantucket with George Pollard, Jr. as captain, Owen Chase and Matthew Joy mates, six of her complement of 20 men, Negroes, bound for the Pacific Ocean, victualled and provided for 2 years and a half. A year and 3 months later, on November 20th, 1820, just south of the equator in longitude 119 west, this ship, on a calm day, with the sun at ease, was struck head-on twice by a bull whale, a spermaceti about 85 feet long, and with her bows stove in, filled and sank. Her 20 men set out in three open whaleboats for the coast of South America, 2,000 miles away. They had bread, 200 pound of boat, water, 65 gallons, and some Galapagos turtles. Although they were at the time at no great distance from Tahiti, they were ignorant of the temper of the natives and feared cannibalism. Their first extreme sufferings commenced a week later when they made the mistake of eating, in order to make their supply last, some bread which had got soaked by the sea's wash. To alleviate the thirst which followed, they killed turtle for its blood. The sight revolted the stomachs of the men. In the first weeks of December, their lips began to crack and swell, and a glutinous saliva collected in the mouth, intolerable to the taste. Their bodies commenced to waste away, and possessed so little strength, they had to assist each other in performing some of the body's weakest functions. Barnacles collected on the boat's bottoms, and they tore them off for food. A few flying fish struck their sails, fell into the boats, and were swallowed raw. After a month of the open sea, they were gladdened by the sight of a small island, which they took to be Ducey, but was Elizabeth Isle. Currents and storm had taken them 1,000 miles off their course. They found water on the island after a futile search for it from rocks which they picked at where moisture was with their hatchets. It was discovered in a small spring in the sand at the extreme verge of ebb tide. They could gather it only at low water. The rest of the time the sea flowed over the spring to the depth of 6 feet. 20 men could not survive on the island, and to give themselves the chance to reach the mainland before the supplies they had from the ship should be gone, 17 of them put back to sea, December 27th. The three who stayed, Thomas Chappell of Plymouth, England, and William Wright and Seth Weeks of Barnstable, Massachusetts, took shelter in caves among the rocks. In one they found 8 human skeletons side by side, as though they had lain down and died together. The only food the three had was a sort of blackbird which they caught when it roosted in trees and whose blood they sucked. With the meat of the bird and a few eggs, they chewed a plant tasting like peppergrass which they found in the crevices of the rocks. They survived. The three boats, with the 17 men divided among them, moved under the sun across the ocean together until the 12th of January, when during the night, the one under the command of Owen Chase, first mate, became separated from the other two. Already one of the 17 had died, Matthew Joy, second mate. He'd been buried January 10th. When Charles Shorter, Negro, out of the same boat as Joy, died on January 23rd, his body was shared among the men of that boat and the captains and eaten. 2 days more and Lawson Thomas, Negro, died and was eaten. Again 2 days and Isaac Shepherd, Negro, died and was eaten. The bodies were roasted to dryness by means of fires kindled on the ballast sand at the bottom of the boats. 2 days later, the 29th, during the night, the boat which had been Matthew Joy's got separated from the captains and was never heard of again. When she disappeared, 3 men still lived: William Barn, Negro, Obed Hendricks, and Joseph West. In the captain's boat, now alone in the sea, 4 men kept on. The fifth, Samuel Reed, Negro, had been eaten for strength at his death the day before. Within 3 days, these four men, calculating the miles they had to go, decided to draw two lots, one to choose who should die that the others might live, and one to choose who should kill him. The youngest, Owen Coffin, serving on his first voyage as a cabin boy to learn his family's trade, lost. It became the duty of Charles Ramsdale, also of Nantucket, to shoot him. He did, and he, the captain, and Brazil Ray, Nantucket, ate him. That was February 1st, 1821. On February 11th, Ray died of himself and was eaten. On February 23rd, the captain and Ramsdale were picked up by the Nantucket whale ship Dolphin, Captain Zimri Cook. The men in the third boat under the command of Owen Chase, the first mate, held out the longest. They had become separated from the other two boats before hunger and thirst had driven any of the Essex men to extremity. Owen Chase's crew had buried their first death, Richard Peterson, Negro, on January 20th. It was not until February 8th, when Isaac Cole died in convulsions, that Owen Chase was forced, some 2 weeks later than in the other boats, to propose to his two men, Benjamin Lawrence and Thomas Nickerson, that they should eat of their own flesh. It happened to them this once in this way. They separated the limbs from the body and cut all the flesh from the bones, after which they opened the body, took out the heart, closed the body again, sewed it up as well as they could, and committed it to the sea. They drank of the heart and ate it. They ate a few pieces of the flesh and hung the rest, cut in thin strips, to dry in the sun. They made a fire, as the captain had, and roasted some to serve them the next day. The next morning, they found that the flesh in the sun had spoiled, had turned green. They made another fire to cook it, to prevent its being wholly lost. For 5 days they lived on it, not using of their remnant of bread. They recruited their strength on the flesh, eating it in small pieces with salt water. By the 14th, they were able to make a few attempts at guiding the boat with an oar. On the 15th, the flesh was all consumed, and they had left the last of their bread, 2 seed biscuits. Their limbs had swelled during the last 2 days, and now began to pain them excessively. They judged they still had 300 miles to go. On the 17th, the settling of a cloud led Chase to think that land was near. Notwithstanding, the next morning, Nickerson, 17 years of age, after having bailed a boat, lay down, drew a piece of canvas up over him, and said that he then wished to die immediately. On the 19th, at 7 in the morning, Lawrence saw a sail at 7 miles, and the three of them were taken up by the brig Indian of London, Captain William Crozier. It is not known what happened in later years to the three men who survived the island, but the four Nantucket men who, with the captain, survived the sea all became captains themselves. They died old, Nickerson at 77, Ramsdale, who was 19 on the Essex, at 75, Chase, who was 24, at 73, Lawrence, who was 30, at 80, and Pollard, the captain, who had been 31 at the time, lived until 1870, age 81.